Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You might remember the early days of fighting with your siblings, running, jumping, screaming, growing up. They were antagonists, playmates, confidants, best friends. Maybe they propped you up when others put you down. Maybe they pulled you down when you wanted to shine. A new book looks at how siblings shape the adults we become. This hour on Point, the stamp of siblings. You can join the conversation. How have siblings helped shape, make you? What did you learn from them? Share with them. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio, or post pictures of you and your siblings on our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Jeffrey Kluger, senior editor and writer at Time Magazine and co-author of the best-selling book Apollo 13. His new book is The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. Jeffrey Kluger, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I guess we're sent out in the world, what, partly by how we're raised, and you've got a family story of your own here, partly by our work. Time Magazine had you out looking at the new science of siblings. You've put a lot of it together here. What's the headline?
The headline is that your siblings, not fully appreciated by scientists until recently, really are the family members and perhaps the people in the world who do the most to shape, to define, to refine you into the person you're going to be one day. As you said at the top of the hour, our parents leave us too early, our spouses and our kids come along later, but it's only our siblings who are with us for the entire ride.
Though that's not exactly where people have looked traditionally. I mean, Sigmund Freud comes along and he looks at mothers and fathers and Oedipal complexes and all the rest. Not in his first round of psychological science, it's siblings.
That's exactly right. And in fact, one of the points I made both in the Time Magazine story a few years ago and in the Sibling Effect is that this is a relatively young discipline. The sort of monomaniacal focus on siblings hasn't really been going on for more than 15 years or so. The thinking was siblings were just too fungible. They're sort of the commodities of the family. Families would stock their shelves with children until they were done. And basically, the only limits were sperm, egg, and economics. There was nobody, it seemed at the time, who could influence you more than your family, than your parents, of course, but also your teachers and even your peers with whom you're spending sometimes more time when you're out of school than you are at home. Siblings also got overlooked by researchers because, as one researcher told me, the complexity of the science just turned too many people off. There's the number of siblings, there's age gap, there's gender, there's the question of singletons and multiple births, there's income, there's culture. There were just so many X factors that people said, you know what, let's just focus on the obvious stuff.
There's no cookie cutter here around sibling relationships in, as you say, number or gap in years or blended versus organic family or, I mean, it's right. Every which way. And yet, a lot of science has emerged. You're citing a lot of it in this book. Begin to walk us into it. I mean, how does it work? There's a million different configurations here, but how do we tend to be influenced in a lasting way, not just in the fight over who gets the last, I don't know, bowl of Cheerios, by our siblings?
Well, one of the things, and fighting is a good way to get into it, because when parents are asked, how often do your kids fight, and they roll their eyes and say, constantly, that is almost literally true. When you look in the 2 to 5 age group, the frequency of fighting is about 6.7 fights an hour, or more than one every 10 minutes. And by the way, that's not just a provocation, an unresponded to provocation. That's at least 3 exchanges, whether it's words or shoves or a combination of the two. That happens every 6.7 minutes. That's extraordinary. Now, it slows down a little bit, obviously, kids wouldn't get out of childhood alive. But the key thing that goes on here, keep in mind, kittens wrestle with each other. Kids will play all manner of grown-up games in the playroom. All of those things are rehearsal for adulthood. And the level of conflict that takes place among children, among siblings, is also dress rehearsal for adulthood. The skills, the conflict resolution skills, the empathic skills, the sort of intuiting the thoughts and feelings of other people that you learn in the playroom, you then practice on the playground, in the workplace, and in your marriage later in life, certainly when you're raising your own kids.
And why does that matter that it's siblings rather than, you know, the kids next door or the kids at school or preschool? Or does it matter that that tussling goes on with siblings?
Well, that's a really good question, and some of that I do address in the singleton chapter, the only child chapter. There are a few reasons that matters. First of all, you have that total immersion connectedness with your siblings from birth, well before you get onto the playground with other kids, or even in some cases into daycare, though a lot of kids are starting daycare earlier and earlier. So you imprint on your sibs earlier. You're also sharing more intimate space with your siblings. You may, be very, very close to a friend in preschool, but you don't share a bedroom, a dinner table when you're young enough, even a bathtub with your sibling. You don't share that kind of intimate environment. Also, much more important, one thing you are not competing with when it comes to your friends is the most precious resource of all for a child, which is the time and the attention and the love and applause of your parents. For babies, particularly, and this you see this all throughout the animal kingdom, this isn't just the narcissistic gratification mm-hmm. of being applauded by your parents. This is life and death. If you're a baby chick and you don't get the worm or you don't get enough worms, you're not going to make it through spring.
Well, let's march right through some of these categories of sibling interest, and we'll start with birth order. I mean, to talk about the fundamental kind of configuration here, how much does it matter and how?
Matters in a lot of ways, and this is one area in which some of the scientists I talked to said, you know, we got to give it to people, to the masses. People got this right even before scientists got to it. Now, I should say as a caveat, there is a school of scientists and a very thoughtful school that objects to some of the methodology and thinks the work hasn't been done well. And, you know, that's their complaints are legitimate. But broadly speaking, the stereotypes that we tend to assign to birth order positions are real. Firstborns do tend to wind up wealthier, to wind up more successful, to have a clearer focus in life. The preponderance of people in Congress, of CEOs, of judges, of the first astronauts.
Why? Is it just because of that extra little margin of attention they got when they were the only one?
That's a big part of it. They have higher IQs by 3 points, and that comes both from the total immersion focus of being the only child in the house and thus getting the stimulation of their parents, and also from the salutary effect of mentoring their younger sibs when they come along. We all know that experience. When you teach something, you reinforce the knowledge in yourself. So all of those things happen. There's also the sense of expectation, and kids live up to or down to the expectations that are set for them. So all of these things tend to drive big sibs. Big siblings are also literally bigger generally. There's a height advantage for older siblings. Part of this may have to do with nourishment, though obviously in the U.S. that doesn't, and in very developed parts of the world that doesn't quite matter as much.
But there's only one of those in a natural birth order. I guess you can only have one eldest. What about the mid and the younger and the youngest?
Well, the youngest are – here the stereotypes are true as well. The youngest tend to be more charismatic, to have better senses of humor, to have a better sense of intuition. Younger kids develop what's called the theory of mind faster than other people do. And my favorite example of the theory of mind is if a small toddler is in a playroom and a babysitter hides a toy, the toddler will believe that the next person who walks in the room will know where the toy is, because the sense before you really develop a theory of mind is that all knowledge is universal knowledge. It's a very sophisticated skill to learn that what's in my mind is different from what's in your mind, and youngest siblings tend to learn it faster. The reason being what psychologists call a low-power strategy. You're the smallest person in the playroom, so you're also the most vulnerable. So it benefits you to be able to do a little bit of mind reading before the blows are landed. It also benefits you to be able to charm and disarm, and that's one of the reasons that lastborns tend to be funnier.
They learn to watch very closely. You write, birth order scholars observe that some of history's great satirists, Voltaire, Jonathan Swift, Mark Twain, were among the youngest members of large families, a pattern that continues today. You say faux bloviator Stephen Colbert, who yields to mm-hmm. no one in his ability to get a laugh, often points out he is the last of 11 children.
That's exactly right. And this pattern follows in my family as well. My youngest brother is, now he's a middle-aged man, but he's still the goofiest and the most disarming of all of us. My favorite detail about youngest sibs also is they tend to be rebels. And all siblings may be equally likely to engage in public demonstrations or civil disobedience, but youngest siblings are likelier to get arrested while doing it.
Are we prisoners of these sibling birth order things for life, or is it just kind of a starting point and then we grow on, we grow out?
It's a little bit of both, and the middle child is a very good example of that. Middle children, again, live down to some of the unfortunate expectations or stereotypes, which is they do tend to be a little more aimless. They do tend to be a little more lost in the thickets. It takes them a little bit longer to find their way, and they tend to have lower self-esteem. But middle sibs parlay that into a better ability, particularly once they're in school and out in the world, to form connections outside the home and to reach out and expand emotionally beyond the family simply because their needs weren't as fully met. So they parlay a bad thing into a good thing. We're not limited by that, partly because, again, this depends in part on size of family. In the second, third, fourth, and fifth kids, these birth order differences tend to flatten out a little bit.
Jeffrey Kluger, stand by there if you would. We have to take a short break right here.
Sure.
The new book is The Sibling Effect. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Then I ran down the stairway through the front door and I cried. You come back here and I let him see my tears. Said I'll give you my rookie of DiMaggio. I'll do anything you want. Clean your room or wash your car. I'll do anything so long as you don't go. But he said, this is what brothers are for.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about siblings and how they shape us in childhood and beyond. My guest is Jeffrey Kluger. He's a senior editor and writer at Time Magazine, co-author of the best-selling Apollo 13, and now of The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. Jeffrey, we've got a lot of response online here. Jackie says, my brother's the only person that's experienced my parents in the same way as she has. She says, I'm 26. My brother's 24. Our father passed away recently. And even though we don't talk about it every time we meet, I take great comfort in knowing that besides me, there's another repository of memories of everything about my father, the good and the bad. Just what the good company you have and shared memories. Rick says, my 2.5-year-old sister shaped me by telling me how I was going to learn to read when I was entering first grade. Got me excited about reading. I've been a lifelong library user ever since, getting a library card at 7. But here's another, and you write about this as well. Oh, where is it now that I need it? Here it is. Jeff, he says, I often joke about how my 3 brothers taught me my most important lesson in life. And looking back, I discovered that when they tried drinking, drugs, and other risky behavior, I observed it and decided to take the opposite way. Whatever they did, I did the opposite, and today my life is richer for this lesson. I love them for what they taught me. That's funny. What about, how does it happen, this imprint? Some of it's active, some of it's just by being in birth order, some of it's just by sharing memories. You know, where does the strongest impact come in? What about behaviors of the siblings running?
One of the good ways to get into that is with this question of risk behavior, and I'm very glad your listener wrote in.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I'm very glad he wrote in because that is specifically what happens, and it showed real courage on his part to do that consciously. This is the phenomenon of de-identification. You look at what the sibling ahead of you does, and you decide to do the opposite. Now, sometimes this is a bad thing. There was one Chinese study in parts of the country that don't have where the one-child policy isn't very rigorously enforced that showed a certain stair-step pattern in good scholarship in the family. The first sib would be a good student. The second wouldn't be. The third would be. The fourth wouldn't be. Each successive child would de-identify from the one before him, the thinking being that siblings will sort of grow the way leaves do on trees. You reposition yourself so that you grow in a shaft of sunlight. You don't want to grow in the shadow of someone above you. Similarly, another example, your older brother is the captain of the football team and got a lot of kudos for it. Well, you could go out for the football team, and always get no more than 50% of those kudos. Or you could run for student council president and get 100% of the kudos in that area. De-identification can be life-saving when it comes to drinking and drugs and teen pregnancy and that sort of thing, because there can be a been-there-done-that quality to bad behavior in the generation before or in the birth order before you, so that even though those kids are getting negative attention, it's still attention. What you decide you're going to do is seek attention in another way. And when it comes to drinking and drugs, that makes a real difference.
So it can cut both ways, this impact. It can be by modeling or the opposite. Amy's writing here. She says, my sister's had such an enormous influence over me, my sense of humor, my diction, my values. The reverberations from our childhood relationship continue to influence how I relate to others. It sounds like she's modeling there. Some may run the other way. Let's go to our listeners, Aiken, South Carolina. Catherine is calling. Hi, Catherine, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi. What's your story?
Hi. I am the sixth of eight children between the oldest boy and the youngest girl. And I identify with many of the online comments about not doing things after watching older siblings, but also being somewhat of a middle child in a large family. And because of my older siblings, I learned at a young age it's okay for girls to be tough, which at the time I was growing up was very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, that directly relates to my what I consider success in that having the confidence and the perseverance to do the things that I've always wanted to do. And I'm sure that has to do with birth order.
Yeah, and so it turned out to be an advantage for you to be right there in the middle.
Yes, it was. Because I wasn't coddled, so I had to look out for myself mostly. And as a result, became very independent and always knew at a young age that I could achieve what I wanted, and I have.
And there's a sibling imprint right there. And Catherine, I appreciate that story. You've got a lot of siblings in this family, but also the brother-sister question comes up, and you write about it, Jeff. She's got brothers and sisters to model on. And what about that for brothers who have sisters? What does that give them as developing young males, or sisters with brothers? What does that bring them in a lifetime?
Well, this is one of the areas in which, once again, non-scientists seem to have observed this even before the scientists did. You know, you talk to college students, to college girls, and they'll say they can recognize a college boy who grew up with sisters because while he's not quite fully civilized yet, he is more so than most college boys and who didn't grow up with sisters. And college boys will say a college girl who had brothers tends to have an appealing sort of winking lack of seriousness. She tends to be a little less rigid in things, which is one of the things that the college boys tend to value. One study I write about in the book, in one study, the researcher paired up volunteers, college-age men and women, as if they were on a speed date and had them talk for 5 or 10 minutes. And then afterwards, all of the subjects rated the quality of the conversation on things like eye contact and humor and listening skills and all these things that you value in a first date. And they found consistently that the boys who grew up with sisters were rated higher by the girls they talked to, and the girls who grew up with brothers were rated higher by the boys they talked to. So you learn something about how to turn the tumblers in the mind of the opposite sex. You may never decipher it completely. Nobody does. But you at least handle that lock a little bit more deftly.
Let's go to Jason in Springfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hello. One of my favorite topics. I'm the youngest of three brothers and the smallest. But I learned to use psychological warfare to either piss off my brother and get him in trouble or make him laugh to the point where he couldn't breathe and debilitate him. And my oldest brother, I spent much of my life doing my best to establish a relationship of trust and get all us three brothers together, because he left home at about 15 and was in and out of psych hospitals for 45 years. So that's one of the biggest successes of my life, is to connect with him.
And what about after all these years, Jason? Do you still have the same dynamic? Does it still shape the person you are? What about your relationship with them?
Absolutely. My oldest brother and I have, actually all three brothers have had major psychiatric stuff going on, so we could talk to each other about that and trace back some of the unspoken supposedly taboo parts of our family history.
Yep.
And my brother's, my oldest brother's final words to me, he passed away a few years ago, I remember, I carry with me as like a way to live and a way to treat my brother, and I've shared those words with other people.
Jason, I appreciate your call and your story there a lot. Thank you for calling. I mean, Jeffrey, you look at, through the work of, this is psychologist Deborah Gold at Duke University, about how relationships unfold over time, over long time. And she's got these different categories. If I read it right here, she did a survey, and she found she's got what she calls the intimate category in adulthood. 17% of siblings end up as intimates, 28% congenial, 35% loyal. Maybe they spend less time together, but they're quite loyal to one another. 10% apathetic and 10% hostile. What determines where siblings end up in that range of adult relationships?
Well, a lot of things determine it. And by the way, nobody is locked into those relationships. It's one of the points that I make toward the end of the book that, yes, if you are in the hostile category and you and your siblings are – your relationship is irreparably broken – life is short, and you know there are sibling relationships that need to be walked away from, but that's a very small minority. This 10%, I believe, may even be a little bit high, though it's a fair enough number. In almost all situations, sibling relationships that are good can remain good, and sibling relationships that aren't so good can become better. You know, I like to talk about just getting people together in sibling circles. You know, my brothers and I aren't all in the same city at the same time nearly often enough. One of them lives in L.A., one of them lives in Boston, two of us live in New York. My half-sibs are in New York and Palo Alto. But on those occasions we always make it a point to get together, just the four of us or the six of us, and have time in which we can be totally immersed in one another's company. It's so restorative if we ever find any flagging going on, and we really don't. But I walk away from those meals thinking we've once again been reinvigorated. Even little things like email contact. I don't talk to my brothers every day, but we all email multiple times a day. And sometimes just a goofy headline I'll see on CNN.com or some bit of gossip. But multiple emails run among all of us every day. And that's simply – it's one way of keeping blood and oxygen flowing to these very important relationships.
A comfort there for you. But then every family, every sibling relationship different. Bill in Newton, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Bill. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
This is lovely. I'm the oldest of eight children. I grew up in the 50s. I live in Boston. A lot of my family is in the New York metropolitan area where we grew up. And
okay.
The humor, I think, is probably the factor that has kept all of us alive and relatively well. It seems that we all, there's such great dynamics to being raised in a large family. Interestingly, six of us out of the eight have only but one or two children. So I think that was either accidental or intentional.
What about you, Bill? Do you have kids? How many?
I
yourself?
I have one boy.
So you grew up in a family of eight, and now you've got one.
Yeah, perhaps I learned my lesson. And I try to impart to my son as much of the experience that I had. And believe me, I feel terribly sometimes. I feel terrible that he doesn't have a number of siblings. But he and my wife and I are very close to him, and he has some very... I wanted to comment on friendships. It seems that only children have tremendously strong lifetime friendships. And in my family, since we're all still attached at the hip, our friendships are important, but we always know that we are there for each other through good times and bad. And there's been a lot of good times and bad, and they all seem to be, they all come out in the wash, and we still all love each other. It's crazy, of course.
with eight, how can it help but be?
Yeah, but I mean, it was great. We seem to have experienced everything. I was very fortunate. I think the rest of my siblings are a little jealous to this day, although they won't admit it because my mother will openly admit that I'm still her favorite,
uh-oh,
her first child.
Uh-oh, the phones are lighting up here, Bill. I think your brothers and sisters are...
yeah.
Hey, I appreciate your call I so much. There's eight brothers and sisters going to one in the next generation. I want to talk about single children as well. But Jeffrey Kluger, stand by. I want to bring one more voice in here, if I may. Lori Kramer joins us from Urbana, Illinois, clinical psychologist. She's associate dean at the University of Illinois there and professor of applied family studies, founding director of the Family Resiliency Center at the University of Illinois. Lori Kramer, thank you very, very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So here you're listening in. Jeffrey quotes you in the book, but you're listening in as a clinical psychologist to these characterizations of sibling relationships. And I guess one question that comes to mind for you as a scientist in this field is, I mean, how deterministic is this stuff and how much freedom is there? I want to be careful of presuming any particular outcome from any particular sibling relationship, but how do you look at that?
That's a wonderful question, because I think we do have a tendency to think about these relationship dynamics as really being very consistent and stable over time. You know, I've done some research looking at the early development of sibling relationships, starting as far back as when the mother was pregnant with the second child, and then looking at what happens over time and what are the contributions of other relationships that young children have. And what I learned is that there does seem to be a lot of stability in these, at least in the early portion of kids' lives, so that children who start out with a good sibling relationship really do tend to keep that good relationship over time.
What does good sibling relationship mean? I mean, Jeffrey's describing how even fighting may teach you something. So is
absolutely
that good or bad?
Well, you know, fighting can be very good if it's followed by conflict resolution.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's one thing that we really look at, you know. So getting into fights and squabbles with siblings actually can lead to a very good set of social competencies that kids are developing. They've got to learn how to manage conflicts, how to deal with the emotion that comes with fighting, how to stand up for yourself. A lot of very good, important social competencies happen. But, you know, we also see that when kids start out life with a very poor relationship, meaning that they have difficulty managing conflicts, they don't seem to really care about one another or want to spend a lot of fun time together, or they don't have the competencies to do it, that also tends to be pretty stable over time, unless we find some way to prevent or intervene when we see those things happening. And that intervention could come from parents being very sensitive to what's going on and working hard to really help kids develop a more positive relationship in which they are interacting in a more positive way.
How much does it matter, Lori? I mean, in clinical psychology, Freud got into parents all over the place, Oedipal and everything else.
Right.
In your experience, in counseling and therapy, do siblings come up or are they secondary players?
No, they're absolutely essential. Absolutely essential. We see it all the time in terms of really helping kids develop some social and emotional competencies, but also in terms of their experiences with their parents are very much shaped by what the quality of the sibling relationship is as well. You know, it's a lot easier as a parent to manage family life when kids are getting along well. It's a lot more difficult, a lot more stressful. There's a lot more of a negative dynamic that just seems to pervade the whole family context when kids are having difficulties in their relationship. So it's driving a lot of things.
Lord, help the mister who comes between me and my sister. And Lord, help the sister who comes between me and my man. Sisters, our beloved sisters.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about siblings and how they shape us in childhood and beyond with Jeffrey Kluger, author of the new book, The Sibling Effect, What the Bonds Among Brothers and Sisters Reveal About Us. He's a senior editor and writer at Time magazine. And Lori Kramer is with us as well, clinical psychologist at the University of Illinois, joining us today from Urbana, Illinois. And boy, do we have a lot of response online here, all kinds of angles here. Carrie says, my brother and only sibling died 4 years ago. Although we weren't especially close, it's remarkable to me how alone I feel in his absence. I never before realized there's comfort in just the sense of knowing the family is there. On the other hand, here's Stillen who writes, I'm one of seven siblings, so close growing up, so warm. Decades later, I rarely talk to any of them. And then For you, Jeff Kluger, here's Greg, who writes, would you please provide the evidence and methods behind your pronouncements from on high? Human beings aren't soulless atoms bound by a known set of physical laws. To come back to this deterministic thing here, Greg's skeptical that you can make these broad pronouncements about siblings who come in so many configurations, Jeffrey.
Well, and I think certainly that's something that Dr. Kramer would tell you, and something that anybody in the psychological and social sciences would tell you, that yes, there isn't the same kind of hard empiricism that there is when you're talking about particle physics or biology. You can't do a blood test for sibling closeness. You can't do a CAT scan for intimacy. So all of these things have to be observational. They have to be inferential. There has to be a certain accretion of data over the years. And of course, Greg is right that we're not soulless atoms. We're people with free will and with the ability to make choices, and some of the choices are good and some of the choices are bad. But that doesn't mean that we don't come into the world with certain genetic software stamped fairly well into us and certain behavioral tendencies stamped into us and stamped into the species. We are products of our species as well as products of our environment. So over the broad sweep of science, though you'll see an almost infinite number of exceptions to broad rules still do trend in one direction or another. And a lot of what I'm trying to explore in this book are what we can say both broadly and much more specifically about sibling tendencies and then how this plays out in individuals.
I want to ask you and Lori about blended families. You've got a family of brothers and sisters here and another one here. There's a divorce. There's a recombination. Suddenly, they're all in one family, you know, maybe with two divorced parents who get together, and there they are. What about the impact of those sibling relationships? Is it comparable to those of full-blooded brothers and sisters, Jeffrey, from the science that you've reviewed, or not?
It can be. Obviously, you don't begin with the same in utero from the or at least from the point of in utero connectedness. You don't have the same biology in common. You don't have biological factors like what's known as MHC, the major histocompatibility complex, which allows humans and animals to detect kin by scent, actually, though we do so unconsciously. So a lot of that is missing. On the other hand, you do have the crucible, for both better and worse, of the household, and you do bring people together, and slowly over the course of time, intimacy does develop that becomes, if not wholly indistinguishable, close to indistinguishable from blended families. One of the studies I looked at, and one of the folks I interviewed, it may have been one of Dr. Kramer's studies, I'm not sure, said that about 6 years is a pretty good time to look for. If blended families stay together and stay together collegially for 6 years, you do see a lot of these differences vanish. One of the benefits of blended siblings, some of the studies show, is that not only can they benefit from proximity and from that sense of mutual love and support, they also in some ways have an edge on birth siblings, because they don't come from the womb competing with those siblings for the same parental resources from infancy. So you don't have that early clashing and conflict, and you carry that into adulthood. You still want more approval from your birth parent than you do from the step parent. So you're not in competition for that.
Lori Kramer, what have you observed or seen in the literature on siblings and blended families and the relative importance of those sibling relationships? Of course, it depends on how much time they spend together in that situation. But what about the depth and impact, imprint of those?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the answer is it depends. You know, so much is based on when the divorce happened, when the formation of these step sibling relationships has begun within the developmental time period. So, you know, having these changes, these transitions occur earlier in a child's development is probably going to lead them to be more accepting of new people entering the family. A lot of it also depends on how parents introduce these new siblings and how they foster these new relationships together. So if done well, and by that I mean that there's open discussion about what's going on, that there's real clear communication about the new roles and relationships that are being established in the family, I think that's pretty critical in terms of determining the level of closeness that we tend to see between step-siblings.
If all this is so important, what does it mean for children who don't have siblings, for single children? I've got a lot of people asking online about that. Lori, first to you, they could be listening to this and saying, wait a minute, this is so critical. What does that mean about me who has none? Not me personally, but our listeners.
Well, I think that there's a lot to be considered. Young people who grow up without siblings clearly turn out to be very productive adults who are capable of being lots of relationships. So they're clearly developing a lot of the social and emotional competencies that are important for relationship development through other relationships. Yes, they probably get more time and attention from parents. That probably plays a role here. But I think that these young people are looking at other relationships to help also have the experience of interacting on a very deep and intimate level with another child. So this is the importance of friendships. This is the importance of cousins, of classmates, of being parts of teams, being parts of extracurricular activities. All of those experiences probably contribute in ways that may emulate what kids do get from their siblings.
Jeffrey, what did you find in your survey about the situation of single children in this picture?
A great deal of what Dr. Kramer said I did find, and particularly we see this happening in an era in which so many households are now two-income households. That means that mothers are not there to be full-time homemakers and caretakers, which means that kids are going into daycare when they're still in their infancy. Both of my daughters were in daycare by the time they were 5 or 6 months old, and they were both still being breastfed, but we brought bottled milk and they did fine. And I believe they thrived by being socialized early on in their infancy. One of the benefits of singletons, in one very detailed, very revealing meta-analysis I read that sort of crunched the data from about 200 sibling studies, found that singletons tend to skew higher in terms of linguistic sophistication, in terms of academic achievement, in terms of sense of humor, and in terms of their grasp of what's going on in the world around them. And a lot of that comes from living in a home that skews in a more mature direction. When the parents outnumber the kids, you are likelier to be watching some more sophisticated TV shows than cartoons all the time. That's not to say that poor children are browbeaten into watching Meet the Press every Sunday morning when they want to be watching Phineas and but it is to say that their environment has more adult features to it. And just through osmosis, they acquire more adult traits. And so a lot of singletons often exceed kids with sibs when it comes to certain metrics of performance.
Let's go to Stanton, Virginia, and Bridget. Hi, Bridget. Thank you for calling.
Hi there, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you know?
Well, I haven't heard anything yet about being an eldest daughter and having 2.5 years later having my mother had twins. And so I always think I felt sort of like the odd man out, and I was also the oldest. And I think I was, because of that, I looked for a lot of friendship and kind of sibling kind of things outside of my family rather than with my sister and brother. And as I grew older, I think I fit a lot of the eldest child molds, but I can remember the day in my adulthood that I burned out and I just became much more like the youngest child in the family, and where all the things that had mattered for so long, being an eldest child, didn't matter anymore. And I just wondered if they'd done any studies on eldest child burnout after trying to do all of those things for all of those years. And what about an elder sibling who was especially normal in the 50s? My mother would say, "This is my daughter, and these are my twins."
Yeah, and let me ask you about that. I'll take it to them, Bridget. But what was it hard for you to be the older sister to twins, because their bond is so organically tight? Was that difficult for you?
Yes, I sought out a twin for me outside of my family. And when I was young, it was a cousin, you know, in my head it was, we even had songs we made up that we were twins. And when I was older, it was often finding friends who were different from me that became very good friends.
That's a wonderful thing for us to contemplate. Thanks for calling with that. How about it, Jeffrey? Eldest child burnout, that kind of, you know, determined to, like, climb the ladder and do it right, eldest child instinct that you describe. You hear Bridget at a certain point, no thanks.
Well, and I think there is a certain burden that comes from being the eldest child. You do have certain expectations laid on you from the outset. You do have certain demands placed on you from the outset. And frankly, subpar performance in school or in athletics tends to be a little less well tolerated in a lot of families when it's the firstborn than when it's on the second or the thirdborn. One of the things that benefits firstborns, I think, is the area of certain domains within the family. So, you know, if you're not the favorite or you're not the firstborn in a certain area, you may be the one who excels in other areas. We particularly see this, and we're gender stereotyping a little bit here, but we particularly see this when it comes to what's thought of as kinkeeping behavior. You know, the oldest child, the oldest son, may in traditional households be the one who's likelier to inherit the family business or who's likelier in some other ways to emulate the moneymakers in the family. And the next daughter in line will be the one who's likelier to be the one who keeps the family photo albums, who's likelier to be the one who remembers mom's and dad's anniversary 30 years on and makes sure the other sibs send cards. Now, obviously, every family is different, and as gender roles change, so do these roles. But it does, that is one example of an area in which some of the burdens get offshored to other kids in the family. I've become sort of the functional firstborn in my family, even though I'm the second oldest. I'm the one who does much more caretaking of my brothers and my mother, who is now 80 years old. I do much more, you know, making sure her bills get paid or problems get resolved, simply because my older brother went off to prep school when we were little, and he wasn't quite as temperamentally inclined for that. So these things do get sort of distributed among the sibs, and that helps with the burnout problem.
We've got the evidence of all the different ways in which this can work in our responses online on Twitter here. Chris says, my brother and I are very close, but total opposites in lots of ways. We became closer once we realized that, I guess, and came to terms. Deb says, I have extremely complicated relationships with my brothers, but my sisters and I are very close. Online, Presto says, be careful not to perpetuate the myth of the big happy family. The more interesting story is how adults successfully move out of painful competitive roles perpetrated upon them by families of origin. I mean, Laurie, some people do find liberation, actually, in moving away from some of those maybe imposed roles of youth in the sibling ties.
Absolutely. And I think that's a very healthy thing to do if you are faced with really dysfunctional relationships that you've been unsuccessful in being able to change. That's one of the reasons that I really enjoy working at the very young part of the life span, because I really want to try to set these relationships up in a positive way and try to deal with some of those issues early on so that we can enjoy more success moving forward.
What do you find about, I mean, you say that a lot of this in your research may be determined early on. You get along well at a very early age, you're likely to do the same later. If not, then not. How do you change that? Let's say it was very competitive. Let's say it was very rivalrous. Mm-hmm. Is there a path that you prescribe to those siblings? Because they may want to get together and still be, I don't know, tangled up from what I'm reading here online in complications of their relationship when they were quite young.
Well, yeah, you do see some dynamics very early that has to do with resentment or inability to manage conflicts, an inability to really empathize with a sibling. That's something that we tend to see a lot. Little kids, even big adults, tend to want others to see the world the same way that they do, or want others to appreciate their own unique needs. And that's actually turns out to be a skill that we can teach children and adults to do. So I've actually developed an intervention program. The one that I'm working on right now is for 4 to 8-year-olds, although I think I know a lot of adults who could benefit as well. And we're teaching some of these skills about how to communicate well, how to manage conflict, how to take a sibling's perspective, how to deal with all of the negative emotions that come up in the course of normal sibling interaction, and what to do when you feel really overwhelmed by those emotions, how to fix some of those dynamics that occur from that.
Jeffrey, we've just got a minute here. What's your bottom line on what to hang on to, what to let go of when it comes to siblings?
Well, I do agree with what Laurie says about the fact that, you know, life is short and it is relatively easy to divorce your siblings. You just quit picking up the phone and quit answering calls. And that, I think, is essential in some relationships. I quote Ken and Rick Burns, the documentary filmmakers, in my book, and they have one nastily fraught relationship, at least judging by what's in the media. And I wouldn't presume to prescribe to them, but in relationships in which people never get along, you know, there does seem to be some point at which you need to walk away. But the mission of my book is to argue for the sibling ideal whenever possible. And I often say that having siblings and not making the most of it is like having 1,000 acres of fertile farmland and never planting it. You're letting a lot go to waste.
Well, let's hope that there's a good harvest all over the place here, but it is not simple territory. We appreciate your illumination here. Jeffrey Kluger, author of The Sibling Effect. Thank you so much for joining us this hour, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
And Laurie Kramer at the University of Illinois. Hey, go Illinois. Thanks for joining us, Laurie.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.